Looks good.
All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. This is a work session on case number PU-18-381, MDU Renewable Resource Rider. I may not have said that exactly. Correctly, or maybe I did, but it's the renewable resource rider. So, Victor, you have put together charts, and unless someone has another thought on how to start, I thought just diving into the different scenarios, how it's been done in the past, how it could potentially look in the future, and compare. I guess there are, what, three different models: the existing MDU's model, and then Victor, your model.
Yes.
Does that make sense to everyone that we just start looking at it that way? And
if I could make a comment, though, before
sure.
we start. So I asked for the work session because, and I've expressed it a few times before, a belief that it's the way we've been handling, and I think most jurisdictions handle PTCs, kind of doesn't follow the model that we do with the rest of regulatory accounting, where things are spread out, you know, hopefully as accurately as possible over the life of a project, and so that consumers that are using it toward the end are paying their fair share, and consumers that are using it at the beginning are paying their fair share. And yet with the PTCs, which it's not just a little, you know, one-time tax break or something on a piece of equipment. It's a big fundamental part of, I think, the planning process of some of these projects are only spread out over the first 10 years. So it just seemed to me like we at least need more background information into how the numbers would play out if the PTCs were spread out over the length of the time that we're having the projects paid for, and just take a more thorough look at it than we have in the past. Seems like usually the answer has been, well, now we're here, and so let's worry about that a different time, and then when we get to a different time, it has been next time. And so I appreciate in this case we put the brakes on it, and my understanding of conversations with Victor is that people at MDU were very helpful in putting numbers together and paving the way for the analysis that Victor's been able to do. And as I look at this, I continue to think that there's certainly good merit for looking harder at this. So from that point, I'll let Victor explain it a lot better than me.
No, I would just say I agree. It struck me as an interesting scenario when I first started, which actually coming up on 2 years on the 20th, it just occurred to me. Time flies, right?
When you're having fun.
When you're having fun, right. So, you know, I think it's a normal question that I'm suspect has been out there for the past decade as these PTCs have been applied to wind development in North Dakota and elsewhere for that matter, and how it all impacts ratepayers, what generation pays for what generation doesn't, or who gets the brunt of it. But one thing I would like to do, since, you know, this has been going on for a long time, and I talked to Victor about it this morning, and I had sent out an email in terms of not just this particular case, but, you know, if there's going to be a fundamental shift, if, you know, we have to get to that point first, but if we decide that a fundamental shift is in order, then this isn't just a one-case situation. I think we'd have to consider, you know, the value of being consistent across all riders. So that's why I'd sent the email. I think it was last Thursday. I might have kicked out something just saying, do we want to redefine this work session? But, you know, in principle, it's you know, this is a good starting point, so. So what do you have, Victor?
Okay, so I think the chart that you guys prefer to look at is the nice colorful one with the lines on it.
Mm-hmm. Pretty pictures. Not ugly tables.
There are other, and if anybody doesn't have these, I have extra copies here so I can give them to you. I don't know, maybe Brian, I don't know if I got a chance to give you the whole package.
No, I have them up on my...
You have this?
Well, I do. I have a slightly more modern version.
Oh.
iPad.
That's the same chart, just shrunk down in height.
Oh.
But no, a hard copy is...
It looks better or worse.
Hard copy is good. It's a little easier to scribble notes.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So that first page in there, like I said, is that colorful graph. There's also the letter that MDU filed late last week, which we'll get into. And then there's a couple of just kind of spreadsheet printouts of... This is simply a numbers spreadsheet representation of this graph. There's really nothing more on there. Us accountants like these nice spreadsheets, and others prefer graphs. So we have both.
Others will remain unnamed.
There's lots of others out there, though. So doesn't mean they're wrong. So on the graph, we can see the red line represents how we traditionally have allocated PTCs and costed out the wind farms through the renewable rider. We have the kind of starting out a little bit higher, it gradually slows down up until the point where PTCs expire, then we get a spike up, and then it kind of slowly reduces over time. This one isn't quite those straight lines because we're talking about a total of four separate wind projects here. We have two older ones, Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow, that were put in, I think, around 07, 08, somewhere in that neighborhood. We have Thunder Spirit 1, which was put in 2015, and then we have the Thunder Spirit expansion that is just going in. I think it went in late last year, if memory serves. So all of those expire at different times. Their PTCs come on and off at different times, so that's what's making the smaller movements up and down. But that is the traditional line that we've used. Then we have the alternatives that we asked the company to generate, which they did a nice job of coming back quickly with what the alternatives could look like. And all of these graphs are the average residential customer's monthly bill. So this isn't total dollars. This isn't millions of dollars. It's just the average residential customer's monthly bill. So as the company proposed, 2019 would be just shy of $650. I think it's $640, $630 something. $634 is what they proposed. The first option is the green line, or levelizing all of the PTC value over the entire life of the project. So what that means is, let's say, for example, a project would earn $10 million worth of PTCs per year for 10 years. We divide that total of $100 million that it would earn over that entire period, divided by 25 years. So they just get equal application over the entire life. In that scenario, we start out much higher because in the early years there's a large balance in rate base that the company needs to earn a return on that's not being offset by PTCs. So we start out much higher than in the company's proposal, and then it trails off to be less in the later years. In that scenario, 2019 starts out at $10.57 for the average residential customer, versus the $6.34, so over $4 per month increase. And then the blue line, which is kind of in between the two, was another scenario I had them come up with, which is just one of the other ways we could do this. If someone has other ideas in mind, we can certainly run different models. But this is an attempt to actually levelize the cost of the wind farm over its entire life, whereby we recognize the PTCs in order, in the years appropriate to make that value or that cost level to customers over the life. So essentially, you know, once we get to it's just shy of $8, so it's like $7.50-ish, somewhere in that neighborhood, and it just hangs out there for the entire time period. The only changes to it are, if you see on the graph, on about 2032, Cedar Hills and Diamond Willow are at the end of their lives, so they fall off. So that's that reduction. And then in 2041, Thunder Spirit 1 gets to its end of life. So it keeps it much more consistent. However, both of those come at a cost. When we look at wind farms in ADP proceedings, we look at their net present value of the revenue requirement and what it's saving customers versus the alternative of not building the wind farm. And generally, that's against market fuel cost, market power purchases. And in this situation, I did the Thunder Spirit expansion. In the ADP, we were estimating about $19.1 million worth of savings to customers over the life. The levelized value, or the green line, that is reduced from $19.1 million down to about $18.9 million. So we're losing about $200,000 worth of savings. Again, this is estimated savings, so it's not like customers are going to pay $200,000 more. It's just that the savings are estimated to be $200,000 less. And then
on that point, in fact,
yeah,
they will pay significantly less over a period of time.
Yep.
It's just the present value.
Correct. The present value is important. So that is looking at the present value of future money. So this is where people who don't like spreadsheets and numbers might derail a little bit. So it's the thought that having a dollar at the end of the year doesn't cost as much. That's a weird way to say it. Having a dollar today is worth more like a dollar seven. And that's the assumption we're going with. Having a dollar now is worth a dollar seven in 1 year. In 2 years, it's more like a dollar. Right. Well, it's not quite. Inflation is what the non-utility world uses. In the utility world, we use the company's return.
Oh, sure.
Approximate that. So, you know, inflation is more like 3 to 4%, mm-hmm, where we use the company's return, which is around a little bit over 7. So,
yeah,
roughly 7% is what we're using. So
it's actually not an estimate. It's kind of actual. Assuming the returns stay around that rate.
Yeah, yeah. It's a weird one to think about using a different percentage on. I don't. Randy and I had some discussions about this, and it gets a little complex. I mean, to the company, that would be probably a correct representation to use their return to approximate what future money is worth. But
right,
to a ratepayer, inflation may be more appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
anyway,
to me, that's an important point in all this, because when we look at that model and the $200,000 less savings when using the net present value, the less savings for the consumers, that uses that 7%. That assumes those consumers' savings growing with that 7% rate, when we all know for them, their inflation has for a long time not been anywhere near 7%. And so, to me, I mean, it's real in the way we do the company numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mean to say you're wrong.
Right, right.
But I think it's exaggerated as far as the impact on the consumers, that it's really lessening their savings. In fact, sure, I think their savings are significant.
But as maybe I'm misunderstanding this, but what we're calculating it on the company's costs and expenses. So it is a real number. I mean, we're basing it not on if the consumers had that and how much. It's based on what they're spending or what they're how we're divvying up these various the PTCs and applying them as compared to paying them a return, which is a real cost over that same time period.
Yes. Yes.
So it's a real cost in terms of dollars on this equation, which then get funneled down to customers.
It does.
So the customer inflation rate doesn't really have anything to do with it.
Either one of them. It's a really weird anything to try to talk about. So in the current, so let's try to look at it from another angle here. Same thing. So in the current model, the net present value revenue requirement for Thunder Spirit expansion is about $38.8 million. However, the total revenue requirement, if you add up the yearly costs for that entire time period, is $88 million. So what that's saying is, if you gave MDU today $38.8 million, they can fund that project for 25 years without one extra penny and still get their return. But we're not going to do that.
It's what would you do? What would they do with that money if we gave them 38? Would they invest it? Or under, like, how?
So that's essentially what they would do. They would put it into an investment that would give them a return, probably MDU stock. That gets a pretty good return, I think. But that is the theory, yes. So the net present value is saying that given this return, which in this case we're assuming a 7% return, which is what the company gets, including their cost of debt, if you invest that amount of money today, you can pay all those bills into the future.
Right, so again, it's kind of applied to the company and their cost.
Yep.
Compounded 25 years at the 7%.
Right-ish,
we'll call it. And I'm sure there's it's a historic long-term average in terms of their
it's
realized
not historic.
Return.
It's based on current. I mean, that number does change over time.
Current
as in their last granted ROE and their last cost of debt.
Okay. Is that for 2018 or 2017?
2017, I think, was when we last...
Their current rates, whatever it is in their current rates, their ROE.
I think your example has made a great point that I never was able to clarify in my own head before. The difference between the sides. To the company, $38 million now is the same as $88 million over the 25 years. But if you had the whole consumer group and they were coached up to really understand the numbers based on inflation rates for at least going a long ways back that we've had, they would be much better off to pay $38 million now and have it done with and not have to pay $88 million over the 25 years.
Correct. If you would have done that with a inflation factor, that $38 million would be more like $58 million, or, you know, that's just a kind of shooting from the hip number, but it would be considerably higher if you would assume just the cost of inflation. Okay. So those numbers are the levelized model. In my model, the picture gets kind of turns another corner there. So on the net present value revenue requirement, we were talking about $200,000 lost in savings versus the current model. Mine loses about $3.4 million, which is considerable. You know, it's not completely eliminating that savings, but I think it's worth pause. If we wanted to go with something along those lines, I think we should look to modify it to reduce that at a minimum.
Mm-hmm. Well, from my perspective, just to cut to the chase, I am glad that you guys asked for these numbers, Randy. I think this is very good exercise. Victor, your model is kind of brilliant. I like how it looks. The only thing I do not like is that $3.4 million decrease in savings. And as we talked before, if you were to apply just the maximum number of tax credits on the early years, not go into not go into the hole and have to pay rate ROE on those.
Yep.
As what would that look like? And you know, it seems like that would be the best of all the worlds. The customers on the front end wouldn't be holding the bag for, like in our current model, they get all the benefits from the PTCs and the people at the end don't get hardly any. In the green model, the people on the front end really have not a lot of the benefits from the PTCs, but have to pay for a lot of the capital expenses, and the people at the end enjoy the benefit of the facilities, but don't have to pay for as much of the capital expenses, so it balances out the benefits of this big asset called PTCs mm-hmm. to the maximum number of customers over the course of the project. It seems like that would be the way to go.
Which way?
It's not on here. This would be the Victor Julie model.
the green model here, mm-hmm. the levelized model, that is what will happen on other investments, right?
So if we would look at how, so you know, this is how wind farms work. If we would look at a gas plant, coal plant, any other kind of asset that the utility company is going to add, it is going to look much closer to the green line.
Right.
It's not going to have any weird things like PTCs affecting it. It's going to start out high because the investment is very high at the get-go. So the green line does the best job of making it look like another type of asset. Mm-hmm.
Except for that ignores the fact that the PTCs exist, and yeah. they do. So why not use those to the company's advantage or to the customer's advantage?
I would agree. It's not a like asset, but we want it to look like it from an accounting standpoint.
So, say that again?
I said it's not a like asset. I think that's one of the questions I have. Okay, let's treat it the same, even though it's not.
Sure.
Which is, there's an inconsistency to that as well. But now your model aligns the best with the energy savings. Would you say yes or no?
I don't know that it aligns any better or worse with energy savings. It just, you know, the green line, the levelizing model, levelizes PTCs. Mine tries to levelize the cost over time. But again,
it doesn't follow the savings, if I'm understanding Brian's, because the savings are 3.4 less than what the projected savings
sure.
of the ADP would have been. So it erodes the potential savings because you have to pay as a regulatory asset the cost of the PTCs that don't exist on the front end that you're using. You have to pay an earning on those to the company because you're using more than they would have.
Yes.
But if you just use as many as they could in any given year at the front, you'd probably have the blue line would be purple or whatever, and it'd be a couple notches higher on the front end, and then it eventually cross into where
if we were to do something like that, I would agree. I think the blue would start up in between the green somewhere. And somewhere around the crossover point between the blue and the green line, it would probably pass through there, and then again it would kind of follow somewhere between the blue and the green line.
I want to just emphasize, because I don't know if I'm understanding what's being said, on just one thing. It's not in the levelized model, even. It's not that PTCs aren't being utilized at the beginning. They are being utilized proportionately all the way through.
Correct.
Yeah, proportionally. The other models recognize use the PTCs to offset some of the higher front-end costs that are realized, you know, early on when the revenue requirement is really high it takes, like, oh, here, in this, because this is a wind farm, we have this whole other asset, PTCs. Let's maximize the benefit of that asset however we can, even though it's different from how we would, you know, depreciate a generation, another generation facility, use it on to the highest advantage for customers early on.
But
or throughout.
Whatever. This all ends up having to be balanced out. Whatever we use up front is less available in the back. And I just want to emphasize, this isn't the end of investment. We're going to have a gas plant that's been announced that's going to go on here, and that's going to bring these later years up. At some point, the first wind farms are going to be replaced, or they're going to be
repowered
or something like that, and that'll be additional investment again. And so these folks back paying here in the 30s, they're going to have their own new costs to take care of too. And so it just concerns me when we push things back on people a generation away, and that's what I'm really trying to avoid doing.
Sure.
That's a good point.
That happens to some extent, though, at the tail end of all of these models. I mean, what happens if a coal facility, we were talking this morning, you know, what if Sherco winds up and it's a different company, of course, but if there's an early retirement, well, who pays for that? A generation of ratepayers who never even utilized energy produced from it because you stretch this unused depreciation out for the next 10 years after it shuts down, or do you start collecting early now for early retirements? You know, these things come and go. We're looking at one small chunk of a customer's bill when you start looking at all the different types of generation. They enter at various time periods, and it probably, I mean, it's a lot smoother in terms of average yearly cost than looking at a single asset, because then a year later or 2 years later, another one jumps in. And then a few years later, another one enters the picture, however it works out. It's a revolving door of, you know, it's not like it's, you know, every month or even every year, but over the course of time, generating types, you know, assets come and assets go, and they're replaced.
One other point that the company reminded me of before this meeting was the total revenue requirement numbers, just kind of relatively speaking. So, you know, this is talking about the average residential customer's bill, which is, you know, high of $10.50 and a low of, you know, just a dollar or two. The total dollars we're talking about here for 2019 alone, as the company proposed the red line, that represents, I think it's about $13-14 million for the annual revenue requirement. The green line, that starting point in 2019, is roughly $10 million higher for the 2019 revenue requirement.
Say that. Why?
Simply because of those, how we're doing the PTC recognition, where the company's getting a bunch of PTCs this year that we're going to ask them to bank. So we're going to pay a higher rate for these first couple of years. So one reference that they had given me as a reference point. So it's all customers pay. You know, this isn't going to change how much each customer class pays, but some customers use a lot of energy. And this building, for example, their bill will probably go up about $50,000 for a change like that.
Wow.
But this building is a very big electric bill too. So.
To help me understand, the commission considered this early on and, you know, took a hard line saying, no, we want to use the PTCs when we get them, not spread them over life. What was the rationale for that? And maybe Alon and Jerry have thoughts too, because you were probably here, but Victor, not to cut you off.
No, that's fine. I was going to say that Jerry wrote the memo that I saw, the only detail like I've found on this from that Otter Tail case, and yeah, you did. I forgot to grab my paperwork before I rushed in here, so maybe Jerry, if you want to get up and talk for a few minutes, I'll go see if I can find your memo real quick.
Yeah, I don't remember the memo. I remember some discussion about, well, this is kind of like, why do we keep it in the fuel cost adjustment instead of going into rate base with it? And that was because our costs up front were higher, but they tapered off quickly.
Right.
And so if you put it in rate base, by the time you get another rate case around, you put it in at the higher level, and the customers would be paying a higher level for the whole time. If you go buy a new car and you put it on payments, you're clearly better off if you pay that thing off quickly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you got to pay the interest. And so that's kind of the cost in my mind of what we're doing here, is there's a cost of spreading that over rather than just putting it there. And it's kind of like a dollar's worth more today. If you can get a dollar in your pocket today, that's worth more than somebody will pay it to you in a year from now. And so that's kind of the value of getting the money now while you can rather than spreading it out.
Paying it off on the front end as much as you can.
Yeah.
So you're paying a rate base, or you're paying earnings on a smaller amount over time.
Yeah, it'll come off of the return. If you spread it out, the money that you've paid off of it now, you don't have to pay the return to the company on it.
Mm-hmm.
I think some of the discussion centered around, and I remember a lot of discussion, I don't know how many things got written in a memo, but some of it, it's kind of centered around just like your own taxes or whatever. You can't guess necessarily the future and always be trying to second guess what might exist or what you might be paying or what benefit or detriment there might be. And so you try to focus it on the reasonable factors that you do know closer to the present time. You know, and like the commissioner said, there will always be depreciated assets and new assets and all of these things coming down the pike. I know people had no idea how long these production tax credits would last and that we'd be still seeing them. And
another factor that was in the commission's mind back then too, I think, is that it would have meant a rate increase at this time.
Yeah.
And Jerry, not to interrupt, but I did. So that's Jerry Lean and then Alana.
Sorry.
Jeff Coate, Sacco. No, that's I should have gone around. but the recording, so keep going, Jerry. Sorry about that.
Just the rates go up right now if you levelize it out.
I don't remember Mike Diller talking specifically about this as much as the right where we put the being in rate base versus a rider. That I remember him having strong feelings about. But I do think he did have strong feelings about this, that it should be done this way. Currently using the PTCs as you have them, not over the course of time. But we don't have any writings from him on the subject.
From Mike?
Diller,
we
yeah.
We know of anyway. I might have something stashed in the emails that I don't remember.
I couldn't find the memo. I just found my... there was a settlement in the last rate case with Otter Tail from 08.
Oh.
Otter Tail had proposed partially levelizing the production tax credit over a 25-year period to smooth the effect of losing the PTC after it expires in 10 years. Parties agree the PTC should not be partially levelized as proposed. Instead, the PTC's PTC credits will be estimated and reflected in the renewable resource tracking accounts based on anticipated actual credits for each year and flowed through as a credit to the renewable resource rider during the year in which the payments are received. To the extent the actual PTC credits are different from the amount anticipated, the difference would be trued up in the rider's tracking account.
Mm-hmm.
I know I found a memo at some point, but I just couldn't.
Yeah, track it down.
In my pile.
So that suggests that Diller felt strongly about the red. Do you have strong feelings about one or the other, Victor?
I don't. That's kind of why I've stayed advisory staff in this, which is not per my usual. It feels weird. But I really
advisory
don't
staff have... still gives us advice.
Right, and I'm happy to. But I really don't have strong feelings other than to say that my model as it was generated, it would certainly not be my preference. It only has my name because I'm the one who asked him to come up with it. And as I got into the details, I wasn't excited about it anymore. If we wanted to explore it in an alternate, you know, Julie/Victor model, I'd be happy to do so if that's kind of the direction
we'd like
to go.
Did you say Julie/Victor or Julie/Victory?
I think I called it the Victor/Julie model.
Okay. You know, when you look at the chart, the most appealing line from just trying to balance all of this out seems to be the model you were asked to put together. But when you look at the $3.4 million that goes out the door.
You mean the blue model?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
When you look at the $3.4 million and savings that disappear, that's a pretty tough argument to make that that's the way to go for me.
I would agree.
So can you describe to them what we talked about, the Julie/Victor model?
Yes.
And how that mitigates, that would mitigate that?
So in my opinion, the reason that my model costs so much on the savings piece is because the company is, in my model, attempting to use more PTCs than they're earning in those early years. So in year one, for example, the company may only be earning $5 million worth of PTCs, but in order to cover the return component, it probably takes $6 or $7 million. So they are recognizing $7 million, for example, of PTCs when only five were earned. So we have $2 million that was made up, essentially. In the way they've ran that model, they take that $2 million and they add it into rate base, which they would rightly have to do because they're giving a benefit to customers that they don't. And that happens for the first several years until such time that the return component is less than the amount they're earning in PTCs. So if we were to redo that model, I would only have them use PTCs up to the point that they're earned and not go beyond that. So in the early years, that's why I'm saying it would make that number, that blue line, start a little higher because we would not be recognizing as many PTCs in those early years. I don't think it would go as high as the green line, but it would go higher. And by doing that and not adding extra money to rate base, I think in the long run, we wouldn't see that kind of savings erosion. There would still be some, you know, along the same lines as what levelized was, maybe a little bit more. I guess we'll just have to see how that comes out. But it would eliminate that addition to rate base and thereby addition to the company's in return it's entitled to that additional rate base. So it would, as I said, it would make in the first probably 4 or 5 years, the blue line would be a little bit higher. It would cross over and then at some point be lower than the blue line for the remaining number of years. If that kind of makes sense to everyone, I was kind of impressed I was able to explain it to Julie as quickly as I was.
And you think that could be done and not erode the projected savings?
I think it would lessen that savings erosion, yes. There would still be some, certainly, but it would not be to that degree. I think it would be I think we could probably get it to a more palatable level. You know, like in the levelized, $200,000 isn't a huge amount of savings erosion relative
to. So here's the one part, and it's sort of a basic one. I think I followed what you're explaining, except for one starting point. I would describe in the first year, the current model using whatever PTCs are available, the levelized model using 1/25th of the PTCs that are expected over 10 years.
Yep.
And I don't know what is listed here as the Victor model or what you're talking about here. What are the, how are those two arrived at? I heard that what amount of PTCs?
So it's going to be
first year.
It's going to be project specific. So it's not going to be in the red line. Whatever PTCs are earned on all of the projects get applied to all of the project's costs. In the green model, we're taking whatever's left. So Diamond Willow and Cedar Hills, I think they're probably out of PTCs by this point. I don't remember off the top of my head, but I'm pretty sure they are. They don't have any more PTCs left. If they do, it's minimal. So there's nothing you can really do about those. They just are. Now, Thunder Spirit 1, it's already been using PTCs for several years. So there's only, you know, let's, how many years is that? Let's say 7 years of the 10 that they've been earning PTCs left. So you're taking what's left and dividing that out over 25 years. And that's what's kind of hurting the green line to a certain extent. Had we done that on year one, it probably wouldn't have had to start out quite so high.
Okay.
But anyway, what in my model, we would do it on a project-by-project basis using up to the return component of PTCs on an annual basis. You know, maybe this is another way to look at it. So on the red line in year 2025, we're still getting full PTCs for Thunder Spirit 1 in that year, but if we wanted to cover the return component, we wouldn't need all of them. We probably have $2 or $3 million extra over and above what the return is for Thunder Spirit 1 in that year. And under the current model, we would simply use that to lower the revenue requirement in that year. In my model, we would hang on to that remainder and offset rate base to reduce that in future years. So it would get rid of that hump when PTCs expire. We're going to have this bank sitting over there. It's just that maybe this will help. In your model, we'll have a bank from year one starting. We're going to have this bank of extra PTCs that's sitting there helping offset rate base. By my method, we probably won't have a bank for the first 4 or 5 years. After that, we'll start getting to the point where there's more PTCs earned than we need to offset the return. And only then do we start making a bank of extra PTCs.
Are the PTCs, even from the first year, enough to cover all of the return?
No.
Well, so then if you take up to the amount you need to do the return, you will use all of them and you still won't be there. So I don't know how that changes from the red version. That's, we use all of them that are available in a year now.
Mm-hmm.
If all of them is not enough to cover the return, then we're going to use all of them.
It's not going to be for Thunder Spirit, the Thunder Spirit expansion. And I, to kind of get to all those details, I'd probably need to spend more time studying my model and how it was done. But it may be for Thunder Spirit 1. If not this year, but within the next couple of years, there's going to be, that wind farm will earn more value in PTCs than it takes to pay for MDU's return on the rate base. I think I see what you're saying. I don't have a quick and easy answer to it.
In the early years, that model would mean that ratepayers have to pay nothing through rates.
Oh, no.
Except for what it's shorted.
Well, what it's shorted, but also you still have to pay. So what's changing over time is the return only. So if we start out with depreciation, so say a $100 million wind farm over, that makes it more complicated, $25 million wind farm over 25 years, we have $1 million per year in depreciation. That doesn't change. No matter what else happens, that's the same. We have O&M costs that are generally similar. You know, in the later years, it's probably going to cost a little bit more for O&M on an older, any kind of project, you know, be it a gas turbine or wind farm, whatever. But generally speaking, it's similar over time. But what's changing is that return. In the first couple of years, you have the entire $25 million investment outstanding, so you have to allow them a 7% return on that whole investment. Well, today, that's a roughly 7% return. But in year 25, there's really hardly any of that left that we haven't already paid them back through depreciation. So the return, instead of being $5 million like it is in year one, is only like $100,000.
As we contemplate this, I'm reading again the company's letter and listening to something that you said about customer bill impacts that I hadn't previously considered, which seems substantial. We're going to be changing course. The company is actually asking for, which I didn't like initially, but I'm starting to like more as we talk, was to go with what they have proposed because the balance is ticking, the under-recovered balance is growing. And the longer we wait, the higher that's going to be, and the more that impact is going to have on customers. And there's kind of a lot to consider here. There's this model, but there's also the next step, which I think we need to look at, is how does this affect customers in terms of if we went with the green, what would be the, would there be rate shock in the first few years? I mean, what are those impacts? As we look at this, it isn't just, you know, as simple maybe as this, which line do we like the most on this chart? So I'm starting to like what they proposed here more, which is go with what they've proposed in the next 8 months, review this more thoroughly for implementation next November if we want to potentially change this, because we're going to, you know, each year we're going to have these things going on.
Here's another thought. You know, we have to remember that this did come in on November 2nd, and it's a rider adjustment. So it's taking, you know, longer than I would like, and I suspect any of us would, you know, deep down. But when I'm looking at the charts and where we're at, and going back to my earlier comment, this isn't for me just about looking at this particular instance. It's about how we do things going forward. We're going to, in all likelihood, have a rate case come before us again in the next several years. Do we take a more holistic approach in terms of how we're handling all of these? And I know they're different between different companies. And weave it into the next rate case, move forward with this one as it's drawn up now. the order from, I guess it would have been what, last meeting, or maybe it was the meeting before. No, I think it was last meeting. But anyway. and then continue to work on how we want to proceed with this, because there are more moving parts than just this one graph, just this one set of resources.
There are. First thing I would say is let's not push it to the next rate case. That's one thing I know I have learned since I've been here. By the time we get to a rate case, we have a stack of issues this big, and we have enough time to look at a stack this big. Okay. So I don't like pushing things off. We did a lot of that when I first started, and it came to bite us a lot of times. So I would handle things sooner rather than later, prior to a rate case anyway. Now, if we want to go with Julie's suggestion of, you know, we want to have this implemented by November of 2019, for example, you know, require a filing by June, let's say, so that we have ample time to review it. That's a reasonable approach as well, I think. I wouldn't recommend pushing it to a rate case, certainly.
Okay. So if it gets pushed to for 8 months, what would happen in the interim? I'm calling it the existing order, but the one from the last meeting, we would move forward with that, and then...
So if that's the direction we would like to go, that time to review things, then yes, you could order them to put the rates that they've suggested for this time into effect as of, you know, whatever date, April 1st or something like that. And in that same order, I would, if that's the direction you're going, direct them also that you want a levelized or modified levelized, you know, kind of give them that direction of how you'd like to see this happen in the future. Spell that direction out in the order and require it so that, you know, to Randy's concern, there, you know, we've been talking about this for a while. He's brought it up in the past, and it never really happens.
So. And in fairness, no matter when you tackle it, there's always, well, we have this rate case, but that company, you know, there we don't have one from them, and and even with the riders, well, now we have MDUs, but eventually we'll have to decide on the others, and so it seems like there's never the right time.
But. Right. Yep.
Is that why it's been, well, for lack of better words, shot down or not pursued? Just,
I'm not sure. Honestly, I mean, in 2008, I mean, none of us were here to say exactly, well, I guess Jerry was here, but Jerry doesn't remember. So, you know, the exact reasons.
It was a settlement, so if you weren't part of negotiating the settlement, you don't have firsthand knowledge.
Right.
Yeah. And neither Jerry or I would be a part of negotiating the settlement.
Yep. And so I couldn't say why it was shot down back then. The companies have, none of them have recommended it since then. I do recall Randy bringing it up in the past, but I don't think it's had a great deal of push. You know, the company wasn't forced to, so they didn't do it. And there wasn't any other push.
So basically we'd be looking at, if you look at the letter, paragraph 4 is kind of what we'd be doing, and we'd be,
right,
you know, asking, and we could provide, ask them to provide a few different scenarios, I'm assuming.
Yeah.
And so it would be a little bit, it would be more clear than what we've done in the past, which is, you know, basically accepted and didn't require anything different. This would be, we're going to accept it the way it is, but everyone's on notice that we're really serious about looking at different scenarios and what the impacts would be and what the pros and cons are. So let's have that analysis on the front end baked into the filing.
I think the company's serious about it as well. So, yeah, we're not kicking the can down the road. We're taking a more detailed look.
I just want to make one comment for the record about the rate case. All of these things are issues in a rate case. They may not be issues that the advocacy staff chooses to formally, you know, put a lot of resources into, or that the commission tells someone to put resources into, but whether or not you decide something now or next year, it's all potentially an issue in the rate case. Yep. And the public can certainly, or any other interested party can certainly raise it.
That's absolutely true. I would agree. It's just the point I was trying to make is that when we get into a rate case, we have a huge stack of things that we want
to
chase.
Things to do,
and
right.
We don't have enough time or resources to handle all of them, so we hit the highest dollar stuff that's what we go for.
But the reality is we could make changes to this and still review it in a rate case.
Yeah.
Yes.
Do something totally different or whatever.
Yep.
I also think you have to think about its relationship to ADP applications. If you are analyzing the savings in an ADP application and making decisions based on it, then there needs to be consistency in how you calculate those.
Yeah, so you don't jeopardize those savings just through an accounting.
Right. Well, even in, I think what she's also saying is, you know, a future ADP application, let's say MDU files and wants to put up a new wind farm next year.
Right.
And by then we've changed how we're allocating the costs in the renewable rider, that alternative way of calculation should be considered in that ADP.
Right.
Versus how they've normally calculated it.
I mean, you don't want to make an ADP decision that says X and turn around and implement it that says Y. It would not be good.
Okay, so we'd go with an interim rate. Well, it's not really technically an interim rate, but...
It's this year's rate.
The proposed rate. Because, you know, as noted in this letter, there is a growing under-recovered balance that is a concern. Okay, so what are you...
I'm in favor of that. I also recognize Randy's eager to kind of tackle this, so do you... Are you uncomfortable with that, Randy? How would you like to proceed?
Well, the longer we wait, the bigger the impact is, and the more difficult it is to ever change anything. And so I just think we ought to be moving.
So the bigger the impact is, why is that?
Because in the meantime, on all these projects, we're using up PTCs faster than what I believe we ought to be. And so when a change occurs, if it occurs, there will be less left to spread out.
So the impact to the customers at the end will be less, basically.
Will be less positive, will be more money they have to pay at the end.
Because you could look at it like if we went from red to green, that would be a huge impact on customers today. So we have to recognize that, too.
It is.
Yeah. I mean, it could be gigantic to some. And that's the thing that I don't think we've even touched on yet, which I would definitely want some time to know who those are and why and, you know, look at that stuff. I don't feel like we have the time right now to do that. Thoroughly. But.
Well, if we are going to delay it, I would really hope that we delay it into the summer, not into next fall, because by next fall, then we get busy again with companies are coming in for siting stuff, that they want siting approval by winter time so they can start construction the next spring again. If we're going to delay it, I hope we're talking about just approving this to keep things going for a couple months or something, but this summer we're having these discussions and making a decision.
Well, doesn't the rider just come up once a year, though? I mean, so are you saying you'd want just a short rate? Because, I don't know.
The rider is required to be...
It's an annual rider, isn't it?
The rider is required to be filed annually. I think they could file it more often if they chose.
Well, and also, I mean, you could do that. You also want maybe a little more time if you're going to have these alternative scenarios and these discussions, so you could have your information coming in earlier, even though the real numbers might not be known.
Well, yeah, then the true-up and everything gets goofy because you don't have the right amount of time in there. So how can the company put that together in June? Seems like... Maybe we could get it a couple weeks earlier, but it doesn't seem like it could be a lot earlier than what the filing date is now, unless we're asking for a separate.
Well, we could have, you know, you could require a, I don't know what we call it, but.
hypotheticals?
Hypothetical dockets or
I mean, you could get an idea of the numbers and how they change with different models or whatever you want to call them, different runs. I don't know that you could get your definite numbers for next year's rider.
Yeah. We could get the shape of the curve, you know, of how this graph, the graphs and different models would work.
What's the impact in the email? There's something about Travis wanting to move this along because of the under-recovered.
Yep.
What's the impact of that? The impact is that... is the impact that if we wait too long here, the $6.34 for 2019 needs to be just a little bit more?
Yeah, like up to a dollar more, depending on how long that waits. So
when because of whatever reason, whether it was the timing of the company's filing, our actions, fact is we're in March now. This isn't complete. I'll take the blame for the last 2 weeks. But it's going to have to be altered because it didn't fall right on the exact time when the previous one was supposed to expire.
Right.
And so I don't see how going early on the following years is any different.
No,
we don't do these things on the exact date.
Right. I would absolutely be in support of doing it earlier. You know, a lot of our riders now fall at the same time of the year. You know, we get 9 rider filings in November, and we just can't get through them all. I mean, you guys can't get through them all to even understand them. We certainly can't get into the details to be comfortable with them. You know, ideally, a rider filed in November 2nd should be able to be through us and approved by before January 1 for an implementation date. But when we get them all at the same time, especially when there's other things going on, it's just not feasible. So I know when I first started, I remember we had a lot of consternation about, well, these riders are, we're moving this from the transmission rider into the renewable rider or the generation rider. So it felt like we were doing these pocket swaps, and I know you guys weren't excited about that because they all happened at different times. Well, this one's going down, but the other one's going to go up and offset it, or vice versa. But now they all happen at the same time, so you can see all those things happen, but it doesn't give us a lot of time, either of us, to.
Well, you know, in fairness, though, I totally understand where you're at. And just to be fair, this rider, how many November 1st has this come up, the rider itself? I mean, how long has it been around?
It was... What's that?
5 years.
At least 2008, wasn't it, in that?
Otter Tales.
Oh, that's Otter Tales.
Yeah, that was Otter Tales.
Well, the point I'm making
is... Okay, we got to wrap up here.
This has been out there for debate for a long time, and it's been talked about, but we've got a growing balance, and I think... So what are we going to do, tighten it up into having some numbers by...
For your pleasure, I mean, we can write whatever you want into the order. If you want to require them to file some modeling, file proposed models by June, July, something like that. You know, essentially, you could direct them to work with staff on both sides to come up with some reasonable models well in advance of the next filing.
Right.
So that we can have real numbers for the different models at the next filing. Is that...
What am I thinking?
What are you about to say? Yeah.
Just to prove the order that we held over last time and put it on tomorrow's agenda and go from there.
Well, I think the go from there, though, is to have... Is it June 1st or is it July 1st? Or what date are we trying to pin down here?
I'm comfortable with whatever you guys are comfortable with. I'm comfortable with, you know, dealing with it on next year's filing and having them getting us stuff earlier. I'm comfortable with an interim approach requiring them to come in sooner. So however you guys want to settle that out, or if we want to, I don't know, does it have to be in the order? Does that have to be in the order?
It doesn't have to be. I think we can certainly have the company do this. But if, you know, to Randy's concern, if we don't have a firm, you must do this, it's easy for that kind of stuff not to happen.
But I think it's pretty clear now that everybody wants this. And I think that it would probably be a lot more productive to get some input from the company on what the timing might be in terms of what's reasonable, and get that input into consideration at least before we start drawing deadlines just out of thin air.
Okay, if we're
good with that.
Okay.
Okay, then we'll have that actually.
So Jerry will put the order
I just have to determine.
As it was proposed last time on the agenda, I guess what I'm hearing.
Isn't that what happens anyways? What was it, withdrawn or delayed?
We would have to add it right now.
You want it added to tomorrow.
No, but with just so I'm clear, but with a date, a follow-up date.
I think what I was hearing is no follow-up date, that we would I will work with MDU and come up with models that we can require them to file with the next annual update.
Or you can, I think you should talk to MDU, and Tammy's been sitting here. She knows the concerns. Figure out whether it makes sense to do something this summer to change it and get off the schedule of this, or if it makes, and then come back with a recommendation of how we're going to deal with this for the next time around. And then everybody's on the same page. And I'm comfortable that MDU doesn't need it in an order. If we come up with an agreement on when it's going to be filed, they'll file it then.
I'm fine with that.
Are you comfortable with that part, Randy?
I'm skeptical, but this is what it is.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Wrapped up.
So that's it.